I smile. He's a little intimidated by me. We can't count much on that, though. They walk down the middle of the highway. It was strange to see the yellow line under their feet. Strange. Fallout Alley Youth Zone, Astrid said. Yeah, I guess that will stick, huh? Maybe it's not just a joke, Astrid said. Maybe this is about Fallout Alley. Sam looked sharply at her. You mean maybe an accident at the nuclear plant? She shrugged. I'm not sure I mean anything. But you think it could be connected? Like the plant blew up or something? The power is still on. Perdido Beach gets all its power from the plant. The lights are still on, so one way or the other, the plant is still running. Adelio stopped. Hey, guys. Why are we walking? Because that jerk Orc and that tool Howard stole our golf cart, Quinn said. Dude, Adelio said, and pointed at a car that had plunged off the road and come to a stop in the drainage ditch. There were two bikes mounted on a truck-top bike rack. I feel bad taking someone's bike, Astrid said.
Get over it, Quinn said. Haven't you noticed? It's a whole new world. It's the phase.
Astrid peered up at a seagull floating not far above them. Yes, Quinn, I did notice. They took the two bikes and rode two on, Quinn perched on Adelio's handlebars, Astrid on Sam's. Her hair blew in his face, stinging him a little. Sam was sorry when they located two more bikes. The highway did not go to the power plant. They had to turn onto a side road. There was an impressive stone guardhouse at the turnoff and a red-striped gate, like the ones at a railroad crossing. It was lowered to bar the way. They pedaled around it. The road wound through hillsides carpeted in desiccated grass and wilting yellow wildflowers. There were no homes or businesses near the plant. It was surrounded by hundreds of acres of emptiness in all directions. Steep hillsides and infrequent stands of trees, meadows and dry creeks. Eventually, the road veered down to the tumbled rock shoreline. The view was stunning, but the surf, normally explosive, was gentle, tamed. The road rose and fell, wound back on itself a couple of times, hid behind hills, and then opened on a new panorama of the ocean. "There's another security gate up ahead," Astrid said.
If there's a guard there, I'll kiss him, Quinn said.
This is all constantly watched and patrolled, Astrid said. They have almost a private army that protects the plant.
Not anymore, Sam said.
They came to a chain-link fence topped with razor wire. The fence extended down to the rocks on the left and disappeared up into the hills on the right. There was a much more serious guardhouse here, almost a fortress. It looked like it could handle a major attack. The gate was a tall section of chain link that could roll back and forth at the push of a button. They stopped pedaling and stood looking up at the obstacle.
How do we get in?
Astrid wondered.
Someone climbs the gate, Sam said.
Rock, paper, scissors? The three boys did rock, paper, scissors, and Sam lost.
Dude, paper? Come on, Quinn teased. Everybody knows you go with scissors on the first round.
Sam scaled the chain link quickly, but the razor wire gave him pause. He took off his shirt and wrapped it around the most troublesome strand of wire. He carefully swung a leg over and yelped as the wire nicked his thigh. Then he was over. He dropped to the ground, leaving his shirt behind on the wire. He entered the guardhouse. The air conditioning was on, full blast, making him instantly regret the loss of his shirt. A bank of color monitors showed the road they had just come down, as well as a rotating array of outdoor scenes, ocean and rock and mountain. It also showed several pass-card-protected doors to the plant. In the restroom, he spotted an electronic pass card on a lanyard hanging from a hook. Some guy had been using the can when he disappeared. Sam hung the lanyard around his neck. In a closet off the main room, he found a gray-green military-style uniform shirt, many sizes too large. Against the wall was a locked rack of automatic weapons, machine pistols. The room smelled of oil and sulfur. He looked for a long time at the guns. Automatic weapons versus baseball bats. "Don't go down that road," Sam muttered. He left the gun closet and closed the door firmly, but his hand rested on the knob a while. Then he shook his head. No. It had not gotten to that point. Not yet. The force of the temptation made him queasy. What was the matter with him that he had even considered it for a second? He pushed the button to open the gate.
"What took you so long?" Quinn asked suspiciously.
"I was looking around for a shirt." The power plant stood in perfect isolation, a vast, imposing complex of warehouse-like buildings dominated by two immense, concrete bell jar domes. All his life, Sam had heard about the power plant. It seemed like half the people in Perdido Beach worked here. Growing up, he had heard the recited reassurances, and he wasn't afraid of nuclear power, really. But now, seeing the actual plant, a bright, bristling beast crouched above the sea and beneath the mountains, it made him nervous. "You could pile every house in Perdido Beach into this place," Sam said. "I've never seen it up close. It's big."
"It kind of reminds me of when I was in Rome and saw St. Peter's, this really big cathedral," Quinn said. "It's like, you know, you feel small looking at it. Like maybe you should kneel down just to be on the safe side."
"Stupid question, right? But we aren't going to get radioactive, are we?"
Adelio asked.
"This isn't Chernobyl," Astrid said tartly. "They didn't even have containment towers there. That's what the two big domes are. The actual reactors are under the containment domes, so if anything does happen, the radioactive gas or steam is contained inside."
Quinn slapped Adelio on the back, fake friendly.
"And that's why there's nothing to worry about. Except, huh, they call this area Fallout Alley. I wonder why. What with everything being totally safe and all."
Quinn and Sam knew the story, but for Adelio's benefit, Astrid pointed at the more distant of the two domes.
"See how the color is different? The one dome looks newer. The dome over there was hit by a meteorite. Almost 15 years ago. But what are the odds of that ever happening again?"
"What were the odds of it happening once?"
Quinn muttered.
"A meteorite?"
Adelio echoed, and he glanced up at the sky. The sun was well past its high point and settling toward the water.
"A small meteorite moving at high speed," Astrid said. "It hit the containment vessel and blew it up. Vaporized it. It hit the reactor and just kept going. Actually, it was good it was moving so fast."
Sam saw the picture in his head. He could imagine the big space rock hurtling down at impossible speed, trailing fire, blowing the concrete dome apart.
Why is it good that it was so fast? Sam asked.
Because it drilled into the earth and carried 90% of the uranium fuel down with it into the crater. It pushed it almost 100 feet down. So they basically just filled in the hole, paved it over, and rebuilt the reactor.
I heard a guy was killed, Sam said.
Astrid nodded. One of the engineers. I guess he was working in the reactor area.
You telling me there's a bunch of uranium under the ground and no one is supposed to think that's dangerous?
Adelio said skeptically.
A bunch of uranium and one dude's bones, Quinn said. Welcome to Perdido Beach, where our slogan is, radiation? What radiation?
Astrid led the way. She had visited the plant many times with her father. She found an unmarked, unremarkable door in the slab side of the turbine building. Sam swiped the pass card in the slot, and the door clicked open. Inside, they found a cavernous space with a high ceiling of interlaced I-beams and a painted concrete floor. There were 4 massive engines, each bigger than a locomotive. The noise was incredible.
These are the turbines, Astrid shouted over the hurricane howl. The uranium creates a reaction that heats up water, which makes steam, which comes here, spins the turbines, and generates electricity.
So you're saying it doesn't involve giant hamsters on a wheel? Quinn yelled. I was misinformed.
I guess we better look here first, Sam shouted.
He looked at Quinn. Quinn performed a languid, mocking salute. They spread out through the turbine room. Astrid reminded them that little Pete usually wouldn't come when called. The only way to find him was to look in every corner, every space where a little kid could possibly stand, sit, or hide. Little Pete was not in the turbine room. Astrid finally signaled them to move on. After passing through 2 sets of doors, they could hear normal speech again.
Let's go to the control room, Astrid suggested,
and led the way down a gloomy corridor and into a dated-looking control room. It looked like a set from a NASA space launch, with old-school computers, flickering monitors, and way too many panels with way too many glowing lights, switches, and ancient data ports. There, sitting on the control room floor, rocking slightly back and forth, playing a muted handheld video game, was little Pete. Astrid did not run to him. She stared with what looked to Sam like something close to disappointment. She seemed almost to shrink down a little. But then, she forced a smile and went to him.
Petey,
Astrid said in a calm voice, like he had never been missing, like they'd been together all along, and there was nothing weird about seeing him all alone in the middle of a nuclear plant control room playing Pokemon on a Game Boy.
Thank God he wasn't in with the reactors, Quinn said. I was gonna say a big N-O to searching that.
Adelio nodded agreement. Little Pete was 4 years old, blonde like his big sister, but freckled and almost girlish, he was so pretty. He didn't look at all slow or stupid. In fact, if you didn't know better, you'd have thought he was a normal, probably smart kid. But when Astrid hugged him, he seemed barely to notice. Only after almost a minute did he lift one hand from the video game control and touch her hair in an abstracted way.
"Have you had anything to eat?"
Astrid asked. Then she revised the question.
"Hungry?"
She had a particular way of talking to little Pete when she wanted his attention. She held his face in her hands, carefully blocking his peripheral vision, half covering his ears. She put her face close to his and spoke calmly but with slow, careful enunciation.
"Hungry?"
she repeated slowly but firmly. Little Pete's eyes flickered. He nodded yes.
"Okay,"
Astrid said. Adelio was inspecting the dated-looking electronics that covered most of one wall. He frowned and wrinkled his brow.
"Everything looks like it's normal," he reported.
Quinn scoffed.
"I'm sorry, are you a nuclear engineer as well as a golf cart driver?" "I'm just looking at the readouts, man. I figure green is good, right?"
He moved to a low, curved table supporting three computer monitors before three battered swivel chairs.
"I can't even read this stuff,"
Adelio admitted, peering closely at one monitor. "It's all numbers and symbols."
"I'm going to the break room to find some food for Petey,"
Astrid announced. She started to move away, but little Pete began to whimper. It was the sound a puppy makes when it wants something. Astrid looked pleadingly at Sam.
"Most of the time he doesn't realize I'm around. I hate to leave him when he's relating."
"I'll get the food," Sam said. "What does he like?"
"Chocolate is never refused. He..."
She started to say more, but stopped herself.
"I'll get him something," Sam said.
Adelio had moved on to what seemed to be the most up-to-date piece of equipment in the room, a plasma screen mounted on the wall. Quinn was looking up at the screen as well, rotating slowly in one of the engineer's chairs.
"See if you can get another channel. That one's boring."
"It's a map," Adelio said. "There's Perdido Beach. There's some little towns back in the hills. It goes all the way to San Luis." The map glowed pale blue, white, and pink, with a red bullseye in the center.
"The pink is the fallout pattern in case there is ever a release," Astrid said. "The red is the immediate area where the radiation would be intense. It gets data on wind patterns, the contours of the land, the jet stream, all that, and adjusts it."
"The red and the pink, that's the danger?"
Adelio asked.
"Yes. That's the plume where the fallout would be above acceptable levels."
"That's a lot of land," Adelio said.
"But it's weird,"
Astrid said. She guided little Pete to his feet and went closer to the map.
"I've never seen it look like that. Usually the plume goes inland, you know, from the prevailing winds coming off the ocean. Sometimes the plume stretches all the way down to Santa Barbara, or else up across the national park, depending on weather."
The pink pattern was a perfect circle. The red zone was like a bullseye inside that outer circle.
"The computer's not getting satellite weather data," Astrid said, "so it must have reverted to its default setting, which is the red circle with a 10-mile radius and a pink circle with a 100-mile radius."
Sam peered at the map, unable to at first make sense of it. Then he began to locate the town, beaches he knew, other features.
"The whole town's inside the red zone," Sam said.
Astrid nodded. "The red zone goes right to the far south end of town."
"Yes."
Sam glanced at her to discover whether she saw what he saw. "It runs right through Clifftop."
"Yes,"
she said slowly.
"It does."
"Are you thinking..."
"Yes,"
Astrid said.
"I'm thinking it's a pretty amazing coincidence that the barrier seems to line up with the edge of the danger zone."
Then she added,
"At least what we know of the barrier. We don't know that it includes the entire red spot."
"Does this mean there's been some kind of radiation leak?"
Astrid shook her head.
"I don't think so. There'd be radiation alarms going off all over the place. But what's weird is, it's like cause and effect, only backward. The phase is what cut off the weather data, which caused the computer to default. Phase first, then the map goes to default. So why would the phase barrier be following a map whose lines it caused? Sam shook his head and smiled a little ruefully.
I must be tired. You lost me. I'll go find some food.
He headed down the hall in the direction Astrid had indicated. When he looked back, she was standing, staring up at the map, a tight, grim expression on her face. She noticed Sam watching her, their eyes locked. She flinched, like he had caught her at something. She put one protective arm around little Pete, who had buried his face back in his game. Astrid blinked, looked down, took a deep, shaky breath, and deliberately turned away. 12. 272 hours, 47 minutes.
Coffee.
Mary said the word like it might be magic.
Coffee. That's what I need.
She was in the cramped, narrow teacher's room at Barbara's daycare, searching the refrigerator for something, anything, to feed a little girl who refused to eat. She had almost fallen into the refrigerator, she was so tired, and then she spotted the coffee maker. It's what her mother did when she was tired. It's what everyone did when they were tired. In response to Mary's desperate, late-night plea for help, Howard had supplied the daycare with a single box of diapers. They were Huggies for newborns. Useless. He had sent over 2 gallons of milk and half a dozen bags of chips and goldfish. And he had sent Panda, who proved to be worse than useless. Mary had overheard him threatening to smack a crying 3-year-old and had shooed him out of the building. But the twins, Anna and Emma, had come on their own to help out. It wasn't enough people, not by a long shot, but Mary had been able to get 2 full hours of sleep. But then, when she woke that morning... No, it was afternoon, wasn't it? She had lost track. She was so groggy, she not only had no idea what time it was, for the first few seconds she had no idea where she was. Mary had never made coffee before, but she had seen it done. With bleary eyes, she tried to figure it out. There was a scoop. There were filters. Her first effort was a long wait for nothing. Only after sitting and staring in a coma-like state for 10 minutes did she realize she had forgotten to put water in the machine. When she did put the water in, it erupted in a spout of steam. But after 5 minutes more, she had a fragrant pot of coffee. She poured a cup and took a tentative sip. It was very hot and very bitter. She had no milk to spare, but she did still have some sugar. She started off with 2 big spoonfuls. That was better. Not good, but better. She carried the cup back into the main room. At least 6 kids were crying. Diapers needed changing. The youngest kids needed feeding. Again. A 3-year-old girl with wispy blonde hair spotted Mary and came running. Without thinking, Mary reached down. The coffee spilled onto the child's neck and shoulder. The girl screamed. Mary shouted in fear, "Oh, God!" John came running.
"What happened?"
The little girl howled.
Mary froze.
What shall we do?
John cried. Anna came running, a baby in her arms.
Oh my God, what happened?
The little girl screamed and screamed. Mary carefully sat the coffee cup on the counter. Then she ran from the room and from the school. She ran weeping to her home 2 blocks away. She fumbled the door open. She could barely see through her tears. Deep sobs racked her whole body. It was cool and silent inside. Everything just like it always was. Only so quiet. So quiet that her sobs sounded like harsh animal sounds. Mary soothed herself.
It'll be all right. It'll be all right.
The same lie she'd been telling the kids. She quieted the racking sobs. Mary sat at the kitchen table. She laid her head on her arms, intending to cry some more, quietly. But the time for tears was past. For a while, she just listened to the sound of her own breathing. She stared at the wood grain of the table. Exhaustion made it swirl. It was impossible to believe that her mother and father were not home. Where were they? Where were they all? Her bedroom, her bed, were just up the stairs. She couldn't do it. She couldn't go to sleep. If she did, she wouldn't wake up for hours and hours. The kids needed her. Her brother, poor John, coping while she freaked out. Mary opened the freezer. Ben and Jerry's fudge brownie ice cream. Dove bars. She could eat them, and then she would feel better. She could eat them, and then she would feel worse. If she started, she wouldn't stop. If she started eating when she felt like this, she wouldn't stop until the shame became so great she would force herself to vomit it all back up. Mary had suffered from bulimia since she was 10. Binge eating followed by purging, again and again in a quickening cycle of diminishing returns that had left her 40 pounds overweight at one point, and her teeth rough and discolored from the stomach acid. She'd been clever enough to conceal it for a long time, but her parents had found out eventually. Then had come therapists and a special camp, and when none of that really helped, medication. Speaking of which, Mary reminded herself, she needed to get the bottle from her medicine cabinet. She was better now with the Prozac. Her eating was under control. She didn't purge anymore. She had lost some of the extra weight. But why not eat now? Why not? The cold air of the freezer wafted over her. The ice cream. The chocolate. There it was. It wouldn't hurt. Not just once. Not now, when she was scared to death and alone and so tired. Just one Dove bar. She pulled it out of the box and with fumbling, anxious fingers tore open the wrapper. It was in her mouth in a flash. So good. So cold. The chocolate slick and greasy as it melted on her tongue. The crunch of the shell as she bit into it. The soft, luscious vanilla ice cream inside. She ate it all. She ate like a wolf. Mary grabbed the Ben and Jerry's, and now she was beginning to cry again as she put it into the microwave and softened it for 20 seconds. She wanted it runny. She wanted it to be like cold chocolate soup. She wanted to slurp it down. The microwave dinged. She grabbed a spoon, a big one, a soup spoon. She pried the lid from the ice cream and half-spooned, half-poured the pint of rich chocolate down her throat, barely tasting it in her eagerness. She was weeping and eating, licking her hands, shaking the spoon. She licked the lid. Enough, she told herself. She pulled out two large plastic garbage bags, the big black ones. Systematically, she filled one with anything she could feed to the children. Saltines, peanut butter, honey, rice chex, Nutri-Grain bars, cashews. The second bag she carried upstairs. She piled in pillowcases and sheets, toilet paper, towels. Especially towels, because they could be substituted for diapers. She found the bottle of Prozac. She opened it and tipped it into her hand. The pills were green and orange, oblong. She popped one and swallowed it by cupping water from the faucet with her hand. There were only two pills left. She dragged the two bags to the front door. Then she went back upstairs to her bathroom. She carefully locked the door behind her. She knelt in front of the toilet, raised the lid, and stuck her finger down her throat until the gag reflex forced the food from her stomach. When she was done, she brushed her teeth. She went back downstairs, took hold of the bags, and began dragging them to the daycare. "I'm guessing little Pete can't balance on bike handlebars," Sam said to Astrid.
"No, he can't," Astrid confirmed.
"Okay, then. We'll be on foot. It's what, like 4 o'clock? Maybe we better stay here the night, start out in the morning." Self-conscious about Quinn's earlier complaints, Sam said, "What do you think, Quinn? Stay or go for it?" Quinn shrugged. "I'm beat. Besides, they have a candy machine." The plant manager's office had a couch, which Astrid could share with little Pete. She offered a still-stiff Adelio the back cushions. Sam and Quinn searched the facility until they happened upon the infirmary. There were gurneys there, hospital beds on wheels. Quinn laughed. "Surf's up, brah." Sam hesitated, but then Quinn took off running, got the gurney up to speed, jumped aboard, and even managed to stand up before slamming into a wall. "Okay," Sam said. "I can do that." They had a few minutes of gurney surfing through the abandoned hallways, and Sam discovered he could still laugh. It seemed like a million years since Sam had surfed with Quinn. A million years. Sam and Quinn parked their gurneys in the control room. None of them really understood any of the controls, but it felt like the place to be. They found that Adelio had rounded up 5 radiation suits, almost like spacesuits, each with a hood, a gas mask, and a small oxygen bottle.
"Nice, Adelio," Quinn said. "Just in case?"
Adelio looked uncomfortable.
"Yeah, just in case."
When Quinn smirked, Adelio said,
"You don't think all that has happened is because of this place? Look at that map, man. Red bullseye that just happens to go right where the barrier goes. Maybe that Howard guy had it right, you know? Fallout Alley Youth Zone. It's a pretty big coincidence."
Astrid, weary, said,
"Radiation doesn't cause barriers to appear or people to disappear."
"It's deadly stuff, right?"
Adelio pressed. Quinn sighed and pushed his gurney toward a dark corner, bored by the discussion. Sam waited to hear Astrid's answer.
Radiation can kill you, Astrid agreed. It can kill you quickly. It can kill you slowly. It can give you cancer. It can just make you sick, or it can do nothing. And it can cause mutations.
Mutation like a seagull that suddenly has a hawk's talons?
Adelio asked pointedly.
Yes, but only over a long, long time. Not overnight.
She stood up and took little Pete's hand.
I have to get him to bed.
Over her shoulder, she said,
Don't worry. You won't mutate in the night, Adelio.
Sam stretched out on his gurney. The control room had muted lighting that went almost, but not quite, too dark once Astrid found the switches. The computer monitors and the LCD readouts glowed. Sam might have chosen to leave more of the lights on. He doubted he would be able to sleep. He lay remembering the last time he'd gone surfing with Quinn. Day after Halloween. It had only been early November sun, but in memory, it was very bright. Every rock and pebble and sand crab outlined in gold. In his memory, the waves were wondrous, almost living things, blue and green and white, calling to him, challenging him to leave his worries behind and come out and play. Then the scene shifted, and his mother was at the top of the cliff, smiling and waving down to him. He remembered that day. She was almost always asleep during the morning hours when he surfed, but this day she came to watch. She'd been wearing her blue and white flowery wraparound skirt and a white blouse. Her hair, much lighter than his own, blew in the stiff breeze, and she seemed frail and vulnerable up there. He wanted to yell to her to step back from the edge, but she couldn't hear him. He yelled up to her, but she couldn't hear him. He woke suddenly from the memory that had become a dream. There were no windows, no way to see if it was day or night outside, but no one else was awake. He slid off the gurney and stood up, careful to make no sound. One by one, he checked on the others. Quinn, silent for once, no sleep talking. Adelio snoring on the cushions Astrid had given him. Astrid curled on one end of the couch in the office, and little Pete asleep at the other end. Their second night without parents. That first night in a hotel, and now here, in this nuclear power plant. Where tomorrow night? Sam did not want to go back to living in his home. He wanted his mother back, but not their home. On the desk in the plant manager's office, Sam spotted an iPod. He wasn't optimistic about the musical taste of the manager, who, judging by the family photo on his desk, was about 60 years old. But he didn't think he could go back to sleep. He crept as silently as he could across the office, almost brushing Astrid's hand. Around the desk, shifting the chair ever so slightly, leaning carefully away from a shelf of trophies, golf mostly. A sudden movement at his feet. A rat. He jumped back and slammed into the glass shelf trophy display. There was a tremendous crash. Little Pete's eyes flew open. Sorry, Sam said, but before he could speak another syllable, little Pete began to screech. It was a primitive sound, an ear-splitting, insistent, repetitive, panicky baboon sound. It's okay, Sam said. It's... His throat seized and choked off any sound. He couldn't speak. He couldn't breathe. Sam clutched at his throat. He felt invisible hands wrapped around his neck, steel fingers choking off his air. He slapped and pried at the fingers, and all the while little Pete screeched and flapped his arms like a bird trying to fly. Little Pete shrieked. Adelio and Quinn were up and running. Sam felt blood in his eyes, darkening his vision. His heart pounded. His lungs convulsed, sucking on nothing.
"Petey, Petey, it's all right,"
Astrid said, soothing her brother, stroking his head, cuddling him against her. Her eyes were desperate with fear.
"Window seat, Petey. Window seat, window seat, window seat."
Sam staggered into the desk. Astrid fumbled for little Pete's Game Boy. She turned it on.
"What's happening?" Quinn yelled.
"He heard a loud noise," Astrid yelled. "It startled him. When he's scared, he freaks. It's okay, Petey. It's okay. I'm here. Here's your game."
Sam wanted to yell that it was not okay, that he was choking, but he couldn't make a sound. His head was swimming.
"Hey, Sam, what are you doing?"
Quinn demanded.
"He's choking," Adelio said. "Can't you shut that stupid kid up?"
Quinn yelled.
"He won't stop until everyone is calm," Astrid said through gritted teeth. "Window seat, Petey. Go to your window seat."
Sam fell to one knee.
This was crazy.
He was going to die. Fear took hold of him. His world was going black. His hands, palm out, pushed at nothing. Suddenly, there was a brilliant flash of light. It was as if a small star had gone supernova in the plant manager's office. Sam fell, unconscious. He was conscious again 10 seconds later, on his back, the scared faces of Quinn and Adelio staring down at him. Little Pete was silent. His two pretty eyes were glued to his video game.
"Is he alive?"
Quinn asked in a faraway voice. Sam breathed in, sharp and sudden. Then another breath.
"I'm okay," he rasped. "Is he okay?"
Astrid asked in a voice edged with panic, but controlled to avoid setting little Pete off again.
"Where did that light come from?" Adelio demanded. "Did you guys see that?"
"Dude, they saw that on the moon."
Quinn's eyes were wide.
"We are out of this place," Adelio said.
"Where can we..."
Astrid said. Adelio cut her off.
"I don't care. Out of this place."
"You got that right," Quinn said.
He reached down and yanked Sam to his feet. Sam's head was still spinning, his legs wobbly. No point in resisting. The panic was in every face around him. This wasn't the time to argue or explain. He didn't trust himself to speak, just pointed toward the door and nodded. They ran. 13. 258 hours, 59 minutes. They took nothing with them, just ran, with Quinn in the lead and Adelio bunched with Astrid and little Pete, and Sam woozing along behind. They ran until they were past the main gate. They stopped, panting, bent over, resting hands on knees. It was very dark. The power plant seemed even more of a living, breathing thing at night. It was illuminated by 100 spotlights, which just made the hills looming above them darker.
"Okay, what was that?"
Quinn demanded to know.
"What was that?"
"Petey just panicked," Astrid said.
"Yeah, I get that,"
Quinn said.
What about that light that went off?
I don't know,
Sam managed to rasp. What were you choking on, brah?
I was just choking,
Sam said. Just choking? Just choking on air?
I don't know, maybe. Maybe I was sleepwalking or something and grabbed something to eat and choked on it.
It was weak, and Quinn's disbelieving look, mirrored by Adelio, said they weren't buying it.
That's probably it,
Astrid said. It was so unexpected, even Sam couldn't hide a look of surprise.
What else could have caused him to choke?
Astrid asked.
And the light must have been some internal alarm system going off.
No offense, Astrid, but no way, Adelio said.
He put his hands on his hips, squared himself up to Sam and said,
Man, it's time you started telling us the truth.
I respect you, man, but how am I going to respect you if you lie to me?
Sam was caught off guard. It was the first time he, or any of them, had seen Adelio angry.
What do you mean?
Sam stalled.
There's something going on, man, and it's about you, all right?
Adelio said.
That light just now? I saw that light before. I saw it just before I pulled you out that window from that burning building.
Quinn's head snapped around.
What? What are you saying?
Adelio said,
The wall and the disappearing people, that's not all of it. There's some other strange thing going on. Something is going on with you, Sam. And Astrid, too, since she was pretty quick to try to cover for you just now.
Sam was surprised to realize that Adelio was right. Astrid knew something, too. He wasn't the only one keeping secrets. He felt a wave of relief. He didn't have to be alone on this.
Okay.
Sam took a deep breath and tried to organize his thoughts before he started blurting it all out.
First, I don't know what it is, all right?
Sam said quietly.
I don't know where it comes from. I don't know how it happens. I don't know anything about it except that sometimes it's this... There's this light.
What are you talking about, brah?
Quinn demanded. Sam held up his hands, turning his palms toward his friend.
I can... Dude, I know it sounds like I'm crazy, but sometimes this light just comes shooting out of my hands.
Quinn barked a laugh.
No, man, that doesn't sound crazy. Crazy is you saying you're better than me at riding a curl. This is mentally ill. This is off the hook. Let me see you do it.
I don't know how, Sam confessed. It's happened 4 times, but I can't just make it happen.
4 times you shot lasers out of your hands?
Quinn was on the line between laughing and yelling.
I've known you like half your life, and now you're the Green Lantern?
Right. It's true,
Astrid said.
Bull! If it's true, then do it! Show me!
Sam said, I'm trying to tell you, it only happens when I'm panicked or whatever. I don't make it happen, it just happens.
Adelio said,
Just now you said 4 times.
I saw the flash at the fire. I saw it just now.
What's the other 2 times?
The time before was at my house. I made this light. Like a light bulb, kind of. It was dark. I had a nightmare.
He met Astrid's steady gaze, and suddenly, a different light bulb went off.
You saw it, he accused her. You saw the light in my room. You've known all along.
Yes,
Astrid admitted.
I've known since that first day, and I've known about Petey for longer.
Adelio still wanted the basics laid out.
The fire, here, this light bulb thing, that's 3.
First time was Tom,
Sam said. The name meant nothing to Adelio, but it did to Quinn.
Your stepfather?
Quinn demanded sharply.
Ex-stepfather, I mean?
Yeah. Quinn was staring hard at Sam.
Brah, you aren't saying what you sound like you're saying, right?
I thought he was trying to hurt my mom, Sam said. I thought I was asleep. I woke up. I come down the stairs. They're both in the kitchen yelling. I see Tom with a knife, and there's this flash of light shooting out of my hands.
Sam felt tears stinging his eyes. It surprised him. He didn't feel sad. If anything, he felt relieved. He hadn't told anyone about this before. This was a weight coming off his shoulders. But at the same time, he registered the way Quinn drew back a step, putting distance between them.
My mom knew, of course. She covered at the emergency room. Tom was yelling that I had shot him. The doctor saw a burn, so they knew it wasn't a gunshot. My mom told some lie about Tom falling against the stove.
She had to choose between protecting you or supporting her husband,
Astrid said.
Yeah. And Tom realized once the pain was under control, he realized he would end up in the psychiatric ward if he kept talking about his stepson shooting beams of light at him.
You burned your stepfather's hand off?
Quinn asked, his tone shrill.
Whoa, back up. Did what?
Adelio demanded. It was his turn to be surprised. Quinn said,
His stepfather ended up with a hook, man! They had to cut his hand off, like, right here!
He made a chopping motion on his forearm.
I saw him, like, a week ago over in San Luis. He's got one of those hooks now, you know, with, like, two pincers or whatever? He was buying cigarettes and handing the clerk money with his hook.
He pantomimed it, using two fingers for the pincers of the prosthetic arm.
So you're some kind of freak?
Quinn asked. He still seemed undecided whether he was mad or found it funny.
I'm not the only one, Sam said defensively. That girl in the fire, I think she started that fire. When she saw me, she panicked. It was like liquid fire came out of her hands.
Adelio said, So you shot back. You did your thing at her. Sam could see only the outline of his face in the darkness.
That's what's been dogging you.
You think you hurt her.
I don't know how to control it. I don't ask for it to come. I don't know how to make it go away.
I'm just glad I didn't hurt little Pete. I was choking.
Quinn and Adelio turned their attention to the little boy now. Little Pete rubbed sleep from his eyes and stared past them, indifferent to them, maybe not even aware that they existed. Maybe wondering why he was standing in the damp night air outside a nuclear power plant. Maybe not wondering anything.
He's one too, Quinn accused. A freak.
He doesn't know what he's doing,
Astrid said.
That's not exactly reassuring, Quinn snapped. What's his trick? He shoot missiles out of his butt or something?
Astrid smoothed her brother's hair down with her hand and let her fingers trace the side of his face.
Window seat,
she whispered. Then, to the others,
Window seat is a trigger phrase. It helps him find a calm place. It's the window seat in my room.
Window seat,
little Pete said unexpectedly.
He talks,
Adelio said.
He can,
Astrid said.
But he doesn't much.
He talks, great. What else does he do?
Quinn demanded pointedly.
He seems able to do a lot of things. Mostly we're good, the two of us. Mostly he doesn't really notice me. But once I was doing his therapy, working with this picture book we work on sometimes. I show him a picture and try to get him to say the word and, I don't know, I guess I was in a bad mood that day. I guess I was too rough, taking his hand and putting his finger on the picture like you're supposed to do.
he got mad. And then I wasn't there anymore. One second I was in his room, and then all of a sudden I was in my room.
There was a dead silence as the four of them stared at Little Pete.
"Then maybe he can zap us out of the phase and back to our folks," Quinn said finally.
Silence fell again. The five of them stood in the middle of the road, the humming, bright-lit power plant behind them, a dark road descending ahead.
"I keep waiting for you to laugh, Sam," Quinn said to Sam. "You know, say, gotcha. Tell me it's all some trick. Tell me you're just goofing on me."
"We're in a new world," Astrid said. "Look, I've known about Petey for a while. I tried to believe it was some kind of miracle. Like you, Quinn, I wanted to believe it was God doing it."
"What is doing it?" Adelio asked. "I mean, you're saying this stuff was happening before the phase."
"Look, I'm supposedly smart, but that doesn't mean I understand any of this,"
Astrid admitted.
"All I know is that under the laws of biology and physics, none of this is possible. The human body has no organ that generates light. And what Petey did, the ability to move things from one place to another, scientists have figured out how to do it with a couple of atoms, not entire human beings. It would take more energy than the entire power plant produces, which means that, basically, the laws of physics would have to be rewritten."
"How do you rewrite the laws of physics?" Sam wondered.
Astrid threw up her hands.
"I can just about barely follow AP physics. To understand this, you'd have to be Einstein or Heisenberg or Feynman on that level. I just know that impossible things don't happen. So either this isn't happening, or somehow the rules have been changed."
"Like someone hacked the universe," Quinn said.
"Exactly,"
Astrid said, surprised that Quinn had gotten it.
"Like someone hacked the universe and rewrote the software."
"Nothing but kids left. There's some big wall, and my best friend is Magic Boy all of a sudden," Quinn said. "I figured, okay, at least whatever else, I still have my bra. I still have my best friend."
Sam said, "I'm still your friend, Quinn." Quinn sighed.
"Yeah. Well, it isn't exactly the same, is it?"
"There are probably others,"
Astrid said.
"Others like Sam and Petey, and the little girl who died."
"We have to keep this quiet," Adelio said. "We can't be telling anyone. People don't like people they think are better than they are. If regular kids find out about this, it's going to be trouble."
"Maybe not,"
Astrid said hopefully.
"You're smart, Astrid, but if you think people are going to be happy about this, you don't know people,"
Adelio said.
"Well, I won't be the one blabbing about it," Quinn said.
Astrid said,
"Okay, I think probably Adelio's right. At least for now. And especially, we can't let anyone find out about Petey."
"I'm not saying anything,"
Adelio confirmed.
"You guys know. That's enough," Sam said.
They started walking together toward the distant town. They walked in silence. At first, bunched together. Then, Quinn moved out in front, and Adelio drifted to one side. Astrid was with Little Pete. Sam let himself fall behind. He wanted quiet. He wanted privacy. Part of him would have liked to drift farther and farther back until he was left behind, forgotten by the others. But he was tied to these four people now. They knew what he was. They knew his secret. And they had not turned against him. The sound of Quinn singing Three Little Birds came drifting back. Sam quickened his pace to catch up with his friends.
14. 255 hours, 42 minutes. Sam, Astrid, Quinn, and Adelio flopped on the grass of the plaza, exhausted. Little Pete remained standing, playing his game, oblivious, as though an all-night 10-mile walk were just a stroll. The rising sun silhouetted the mountains behind them and lit the too-calm ocean. The grass was wet with dew that soaked straight through Sam's shirt. He thought, "I'll never be able to sleep here." And then he was asleep. He woke up with sun in his eyes. He blinked and sat up. The dew had burned off, and now the grass was crisping in the heat. There were a lot of kids around, but he didn't see his friends. Maybe they had gone looking for food. He was hungry himself. When he stood up, he noticed that the crowd was moving, all in one direction, toward the church. He joined the movement. A girl he knew walked by. He asked what was going on. She shrugged.
"I'm just following everyone else."
Sam kept moving till the crowd began to congeal. Then he hopped up on the back of a park bench, balancing precariously, but able to see over everyone's head. Four cars were making their way down Alameda Avenue. They drove at a stately pace, like a parade. Adding to that impression, the third car in line was a convertible with the top down. All four cars were dark, powerful, and expensive vehicles. The last car in line was a black SUV. They drove with their lights on.
"Is it someone coming to rescue us?"
a fifth grader called up to Sam. "I don't see any police cars, so I doubt it. You might want to hang back, man."
"Is it the aliens?"
"I think if it was aliens, we'd be seeing spaceships, not BMWs." The procession, or parade, or convoy, or whatever it was, drove up alongside the curb at the top of the plaza, just across the street from the town hall, and stopped. Kids climbed out of each car. They wore black slacks and white shirts. Girls wore pleated black skirts and matching knee-high socks. Both boys and girls had on blazers in a subdued shade of red with a large crest sewn over the heart. Boys and girls alike wore striped ties of red, black, and gold. The crest featured ornate letters C and A in gold thread over a background that showed a golden eagle and a mountain lion. Beneath the crest was the Latin motto of Coates Academy, "Ad Augusta per Augusta, to high places by narrow roads."
"They're all Coates kids."
It was Astrid. She and little Pete stood with Adelio. Sam jumped down to be beside them.
"A well-rehearsed display,"
Astrid said, as though reading Sam's mind. As the Coates kids climbed out of the cars, the crowd actually drew back a step. There had always been a rivalry between the kids in town, who thought of themselves as normal kids, and the Coates kids, who tended to be wealthy and, although the academy tried to disguise the fact, strange. Coates was the place your rich parents sent you when other schools found you difficult. The Coates kids lined up, not quite a drill team in their order and precision, but like they had practiced it.
"Quasi-military,"
Astrid said in a low, discreet voice. Then, one boy, wearing a bright yellow V-necked sweater instead of his blazer, stood up in the convertible. He grinned sheepishly and climbed nimbly from the back seat onto the trunk. He gave a little self-deprecating wave, as if to say he couldn't believe what he was doing.